So good evening, everyone. My name is Michelle, and I'm delighted today to welcome Joelmin, who has been called the woman who can smell Parkinson's disease, but I just want to be very clear, she's much more than that. It's a very big shortcut, if anything else, to call her just that. So before we start, I just wanted to say a few things. As you know, the session is recorded, but I would like to remind everyone of something very basic and very important, is that sessions like this one are really for educational purposes only. So this is no substitute to medical advice. And if you are advised, you're advised to consult a medical professional if you're seeking medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. We will put the questions towards the end of the session. And as I said, I have muted everyone apart from the new participants who join us as we go. Before we get started, I wanted to say a few words about our group. As you know, we called ourselves No Silver Bullet. We very much a group of Parkinson's patients who met during a nutrition tutorial in the summer of 2020. It was basically about nutrition and Parkinson's. And some of us decided to stay in touch. And thanks to Mark in particular, we basically started getting in touch on WhatsApp and then we evolved from there. As I said, we called ourselves No Silver Bullet, a bit as a joke, but actually it really reflected something quite serious, is the belief by everyone in our group that we need a holistic approach to managing your symptoms. It's not just about meds. Meds have a big role to play, but there's also nutrition, exercise, meditation. There's a lot of things out there to help people with Parkinson's. Joe Milne has hereditary hyperosmia and synesthesia, and she has astonished doctors with her ability to detect Parkinson's disease through smell. And she has helped scientists to use the smell of Parkinson's to diagnose it earlier. I think she's a believer in the fact that it will, in the near future, allow people not to develop full-blown Parkinson's, but being aware of it earlier. Joe has contributed to several research papers and lectures, and in recognition of her work, she has been made an honorary lecturer at the University of Manchester. So today we are very privileged and fortunate to hear her story. And Joe, I will leave it to you now to take us through this amazing story of yours, please.
Hope you can all hear me. I am Joe Milne. I'm going to talk to you about a smell-led study of Parkinson's disease. And our motto, which... I can't remember whether it was Perdi or Drupad who came up with it, is nose to diagnose, which is quite simple, really. But we do put it on an awful lot of our work. So you look at Parkinson's, and we all know these, the depression, the psychosis, the sleep disorders, the anosmia, Parkinson's, and the constipation. But is anybody asking, why does Parkinson's smell? And there is cases where care partners and children do say that Parkinson's, whoever it is, who has the Parkinson's in the house, yes, they smell. But nobody has brought this forward as a point for a diagnostics. Now, my husband was a consultant anaesthetist. I was a nurse, a nursing lecturer when the first white paper came out, and I helped practices get into their different clinics to show the staff how to, so that patients didn't fall through the net. But I have also looked at what has happened through the years. Now, the early citations of 1920, Cohn and Sarbo, well, Cohn was the first to notice that sebum was different in people with encephalitis lethargica. And Sarbo also wrote a paper soon after. Camus and Roussy followed them within a year. It was practically a year. And they were saying that there was obviously some link to sebum with Parkinson's disease. And in their papers, they show pictures of surprisingly 20-year-olds to 40-year-olds with the increased sebum, the greasy skin, and the spots. Now, Bailey and Bremner, along with Camus and Roussy, looked at a slightly different part of this, and they were looking at polyuria and glycosuria. And they also called the problems with the skin dystrophia adiposa. And this was in 1921. In 22, Dresel and Louis, the famous Frederick Louis, said that the authors conclude that the pathological lesions occurring in idiopathic paralysis are involved in important centers connected with high carbohydrate metabolism. Now, this is 1922, and they're looking at carbohydrate metabolism. It has made me think about the gap to us looking at dysregulated lipids and carbohydrate metabolism, to be honest. But in 1927, David Creston, a cardiologist who was seeing patients at the London Hospital with these problems, and again in his paper, he's showing 20 to 40 year olds, and it is called the seborrheic facies and the manifestation of post-encephalitic Parkinsonism and allied disorders. Now, this is a very sad story. He was an eminent doctor at the London Hospital. His parents were Jewish emigres from Europe. The University of London, he excelled. He did Bachelor of Medicine and surgery. He was working at London Hospital. He did do the first study in the London Hospital. And when he mentioned what he was writing, he was ostracized. He then went to the University of Pennsylvania, where again, he continued this work. And again, he was ostracized. Perdi and I speak about him quite often because it is, in actual fact, quite a sad story. Because from 1946, he was a consultant in the Ministry of Pensions for doctors. He had been run out of medicine. So it's quite a harrowing story. I look at the skin pathology and mitochondrial dysfunction in Parkinson's. And I am having difficulties because let's see if I can do this. Yes, there it is. Involve important centers connected with carbohydrate metabolism, the fundamental biochemical process that ensures a constant supply of energy to living cells. Now, I have given you this timeline back in the 1920s, so remember it. This is why there is a story behind it. I have hereditary hyperosmia, and it is a heightened sense of smell. It's as quite simple as that. But I have increased signaling between the olfactory receptor, seemingly, and the olfactory cortex, which is quite interesting. But I have a combination. The hereditary hyperosmia is from a mother's side. That's my grandmother. But my father had synesthesia. And it is a different process, but if you look at it, the stimulation of one sense causes an involuntary reaction in more other senses, so that I can hear the vox, I can hear the smell. And my sister, she has, when she reads, the letters are in colours. So it is quite a family trait, really. I produced this when I first realised what I could do. And this is to show people the different colours, the different vibrations, and the different smells that for one lily and the plants underneath it, I'm having these sensations. I never have quietness when I'm awake. It is a combination of sound, a combination of this light, a shiver or something like that. But I enjoy the sense of smell. And when I waken in the morning, I don't just get up. I keep my eyes shut and I smell. And I can't remember not doing that because I get a sense of what is around me and the noise that's going to be there. So why am I different from my sisters? They didn't do nursing. I was a nurse in the late 1968 and 69. I did all the usual nursing. We were not in a college. We were actually, we had 6 weeks sessions. Again, within the hospital, we were in Nightingale wards. I did meet an auxiliary who could do the same as I did. If a diabetic patient was going off and our ketones were getting higher, we could quietly alert people or ask her or him whether they were feeling unwell or they were feeling different. So this was how I have acquired my medical olfactory library. Now, I've put Parkinson's and tuberculosis at the bottom here. Believe it or not, in my 3 years of training, I only saw two people with Parkinson's. And one of them was an elderly lady. Now, we're in a Nightingale ward. There's no coverings. There are these flimsy curtains. The beds are close together. It's the winter. We have five beds down the middle. And she smelt very different for me. And I went up to her. It was late. And it was a shame. She was the last bed in the middle. And she was going to a very cold bathroom. And I said to her, come along, Lily, put on your dressing gown. And I knew she was going to the psychiatric hospital. I knew there was problems, but I didn't expect what happened. She took a hold of my uniform. She threw me over the metal bed. I hit the next metal bed and I broke two ribs. And I had not realized that there was the possibility of any stress or psychosis, although we know about it now, but she was fairly well on. She was in her 80s, but she was she wasn't 5 feet. And I was 5 feet three then. I was very fit, but she did, in actual fact, quite a lot of damage. So my husband was a consultant anaesthetist. I first met him when the change in his smell happened when he was 32, but he wasn't diagnosed until he was 44. But the first time I realized that other people smelt the same as him, because he had a very strong smell with his Parkinson's, we went to our first Parkinson's meeting, Parkinson's UK meeting, when we came back to Perth. And as we were getting introduced to people, I discovered that others were smelling the same as Les. So I got him home. And I sat him down. I sat him at the dining room table. And I said, I think we should have a cup of tea. So he sort of looked at me expectantly because he realized I was about to sit down and say something. And I said to him, the people in the room at the gateway smelt the same as you. And his response was, what on earth are you saying? I said, well, the people in the room, you know, I've said about the smell for many years, they smell the same as you. So he said, right, well, that's fine. But as a doctor, I want it verified. And the meeting was a month later. So we went back a month later. He couldn't wait until we were out the door. He was saying, well, I said, well, yes, we'll have to speak to it when we get home. I said, because there's different levels even. I hadn't realized the first time that there were different levels in the smell. So we went home, we discussed it. And we both sat there looking at each other. And all of a sudden he said, right, we've got to find the right scientist. And I thought, yes, we do. And so we looked at various meetings that were going to happen. And there was a stem cell researcher about to do a lecture, and it was with Parkinson's UK, and it was Dr. Tilo Kunath. Now, Tilo and I are very good friends now. It was at the Centre for Regenerative Medicine in Edinburgh. And at the end of his lecture, he stood there at the front of the podium and he said, could I have any questions? And I stood up, and I'm not joking about this. This was like an out-of-body experience. My legs began to straighten. I thought, I really don't want to do this. But yeah. And I said, why are we not using the smell of Parkinson's to diagnose it earlier? If I'd had a camera, I would have loved to have had the photograph of Tilo's face because it was just astonishing. And he said, pardon? So I repeated it. And he said, I've not heard of this. So he asked the consultant who sat at the side. He asked Catherine Crawford from Parkinson's UK. And he said, well, yes, could we speak about this later? So he had a word with me before I left. And then I never heard anything. And he went to a Christmas dinner. A woman, a researcher from cancer research, said to him, go and find that woman. So he didn't know. He remembered my name was Joy. He didn't know who I was. He didn't know where I was. But luckily enough, Catherine Crawford did. And we were put in contact, and we did the first proof of concept at the CRM. And he had a discussion with Professor Perdita Barn, who she says to her ever living shame, she didn't believe it at all. I was smelling old people. That was according to what she thought was happening here. So here's Tilo in the lab at CRM, and the proof of concept was volunteers wore t-shirts for 24 hours. Each t-shirt was cut in half. They were bagged separately or randomized, and then Joy scored each half t-shirt. Now, when I first start, my nose can be overcome after about 7 to 8 samples. So these were randomized, so they didn't look as neat as this, of course, as I took them out of this box and smelt them. But if you look, they are correct, except for one. And we got to the end, and Tilo thought, well, she's got one wrong, that's fine, it's a very good score. But I stuck to my guns. Either that man sat very close to his wife, who I'd already asked whether she had Parkinson's. And he said, well, yes. I said, well, he's sleeping awfully close to her because, and then I thought, no, that's not right, Joy. That isn't right. I said, no, I think he has Parkinson's. And Tilo stuck to his guns. No, he's in the control. And we left it at that. 9 months later, the gentleman who I am very good friends with now came back and said, well, Tilo, I think you got to add me to the Parkinson's set because I've just been diagnosed with Parkinson's. So for Tilo and Perdi, for me to pre-diagnose, as I had done with my husband, I smelt him 12 years before he was diagnosed. It was a breakthrough, a real breakthrough for them. But there was quite a lot of hard work in setting all of this up because I smell everything, everything. Has Vox, has volatiles for me. So we had to choose a bag, and I think we went through about 8 or 10 of them until we got the bag. So when I go to smell a swab, I have to get rid of the smell of the bag. And then there were about 5 swabs we went through to get the right swab with the least Vox, and I have to get rid of the swab. And if there is any scent, now the problem was, we hadn't thought about a nurse wearing hand cream or anything taking the swab. And I had to be able to get rid of that if it wasn't too bad. When I got to the Parkinson's on the swab, level one for me is the smell of the person, and I have to hunt for those Vox. Level two is less of the person and more PD odor. Level three is very little of the person, mostly Parkinson's odor. And only three times have I smelt level four. There is just no person. As soon as I take the swab out of the bag, I recoil immediately. I am speaking about it now and I'm feeling the cold going over me. It is quite a strong, but for me, a quite an abrasive smell. It's quite shocking, really, how I react to it. So here is the half t-shirts. But what was the biggest surprise, Tilo and two of his PhD students, well, no, one PhD student belonged to Purdy and one was his. And they'd been running. And they said, right, look at ours. We've got our sweaty t-shirts. I said, Tilo, I don't think it's sweat. It's along the back of the neck. And he said, what? I said, it's along the back of the neck. It's not sweat. So this was a big surprise because Tilo didn't know what was the basis of this smell. I spoke to Purdy again. They spoke to a friend, another research colleague, and he said, well, it has to be sebum. They're the biggest sebum glands at the back of the neck. So we realized it was sebum. And then Purdy was going to go on and analyze with mass spectrometry at Manchester. However, to present day, I shiver when I say this, I said, let's for fun, I'll put them back together again for you. And I did them perfectly. Because not only there are levels in the smell I smell, I could go back to the original person. And I put the t-shirts, the half t-shirts back together again perfectly into the bag. Now, the first paper came out in ECS Central Science. And I had done a present for Purdy to show her how I smelled. And this is a tie-dye that I did. And I said to her, make sure they put the white one with the blue flower fairly prominent. Because this is looking at level one. I have to keep going back to find that smell. The others are the different levels. Yes, you know, it's a little bit more difficult at level two, you know, than three, but for level one, there is this huge area where I am searching for those vox. Now, I'm sure many of you have seen a working model of this. It is the basic gas chromatography. They go into the heated thermal deabsorption chamber. They come out. And by the heat, they're weighed through the coil back into the machine. And as you see, they went in at different colours and come out at different colours. Into the mass spectrometry, where they then come out, I didn't let them go along, but they then come out into what is the world spectrum of vox. Now, we found in the first set of swabs were 200 compounds that came out of the two areas that I found that were, they smelt very much like Les. But there was a huge breakthrough. Now you all accept whiskey smellers, wine smellers, but you also know from, you know, how food is produced now, that there are sniffers who can enhance food. With buttery or malty or floral, or whether it's your shampoo, whether it's your washing liquid for your clothes and your softener. So they had an odor report for the person who was doing this work for all these companies. So we went to Anatune and I started to use the machine, but this isn't in diagnostics. This is not old. for NHS diagnostics for nearly 40 years, they've done the PKU test, the heel prick on a newborn to test for phenylketonuria. But nobody has ever thought of expanding it. It seems very strange, but they haven't. And the Bann group helped to develop a similar test for COVID this year. Well, in the past 18 months, actually. And here I am on the machine. The earphones are for when I speak or I'm wanting to say whether it's large, it's a bigger smell or a smaller smell. It's a, you know, the difference in the voxes are coming through. And you can't see it, but I have a clicker in my hand. And as I immediately smell a vox that is, as Perry puts it, like Les, I click and there is a graph that comes out of the end, and I am 4 seconds behind the machine. It never fails to amaze me, but when Eleanor Sinclair moves it along with slightly, we match. I've got used to it, but yes, a big shock at the beginning. I identified 17 molecules, but four were expressed quite distinctly. Pyrrolic aldehyde is down, hippuric acid, echinacin, and oxydecanol are up. So they're not all raised. You know, it is quite interesting that some are lowered and some are raised. And here you are. This has been done by Deepan Jansaka and Drupa Trivedi, one an analyst and the other one a scientist who has developed the test for Parkinson's. On the right, you see the controls, and on the left, you see the vox that I smell. And you see the two most important sections where the smell is most raised. There are slight walks in between, especially a raised part at the end, but Perdy says it is not as raised. Of course, it isn't as raised because I just catch it at the end of the run. But these are quite distinctive, are they not? I think you would agree that these are quite amazing. When I first saw it, I thought, well, it is quite something. So the research papers we've published from the Bann group was the first one was the discovery of volatile biomarkers in Parkinson's disease from sebum. Now, this was written by our analyst, he is in fact, he's lovely, very, very particular about how he brings things about. But as he says at the very beginning of the paper, Hippocrates, Galenaeus, and Vincenza used odour as a diagnostic tool. Now, we're not looking at the 1920s here, are we? We're looking far, far earlier than that. And in modern times, it has hardly been documented. So they had to be validated, and then I would speak about Eleanor Sinclair. She was a PhD student at the time. I took great delight just over a year ago writing in the book, and the receptionist said, you don't need to write your name. I said, no, I do this today. I wrote Dr. Eleanor Sinclair. She is, if it's not right, she does it, and she does it again, and she does it again, and it's perfect. I cannot say how her expertise is absolutely superb. And she wrote Validating Differential Volatilome Profiles in Parkinson's Disease. And I have given Michael the papers and a foreword for you all. And in the front of this paper, you will see the validation differential in the volatilome between someone who is not on drugs and someone who is on drugs. for Parkinson's, which means we, at this stage, we had three groups. We had a control group, people who were not, in other words, drug naive, and people who were known to have Parkinson's disease and were on treatment. And each paper has their very, the charts, etc., are very well profiled. The one in Nature Communication was the metabolomics of sebum that reveals lipid dysregulation in Parkinson's disease. Now you remember the timeline at the beginning. And here we're looking at the metabolomics of sebum reveals lipid dysregulation in Parkinson's disease. Whether here you could say, well, why did it disappear? It's obvious. The expertise wasn't there. And I have to say, if somebody tried to put the five of us together again, I doubt they'd manage. It's just a team thing. We're called the band group, and we somehow managed to bring the best out in each other. And the last one, which is being rewritten at the moment, is the rapid diagnosis of Parkinson's disease from sebum using paper spray ionization, ion mobility mass spectrometry. Debanjan Sarkar is a technician. He is a superb technician. He has tested over 102 papers to get the exact paper to put the volatiles on to go into the machine that give the best results. And he has tirelessly done this with, may I say, great success. So there are other things that I have gone down in my reading and studying. In Kyoto at the WC conference, Professor Peter Riederer delivered a lecture on the measurement of alpha-synuclein. And I'd listened to the beginning of this lecture, and then he stated that the largest amount of alpha-synuclein was found at the back of the neck. And I froze. I literally froze. I thought, what? So it was very interesting to find this out. So what is alpha-synuclein doing? It's bringing, and we know from what our testing that we're doing, it's bringing all these dysregulated lipids, toxic lipids, to the surface in the sebaceous glands that the university is now seeing and reading. But in 2017, Festini looked at the mitochondria and alpha-synuclein and asked whether there were friends or foes in the pathogenesis of Parkinson's disease. And in 2019, Peter Riederer and Daniela Berg, we do work with Daniela for the Prodromo, published alpha-synuclein in Parkinson's disease, whether it's causal or bystanders. Now, I recommend you read these because the arguments are fierce. They are terribly interesting because they look at all the different aspects of the mitochondrial disease and alpha-synuclein. And is it good to stop to lessen alpha-synuclein? Is it not good to do it? These are questions now. With the connections, easy connections we have in papers, etc., they have, and especially Peter Riederer's and Daniela Berg's paper, they are absolutely fantastic. But this month, Professor Roger Barker gave a lecture for the 10th Edinburgh Research Interest Group and said that neurology now recognised that there was an inflammatory process in Parkinson's. So where is it all going? The BARN group still work with Daniela Berg, and the prodromal studies are continuing. Manchester has now joined Peter Lansbury at Harvard and looking at GBA and lysosomal depletion. The design by Dr. Debanjan Sarkar for a test is now complete. And I hope you will be soon reading it in his paper. Dr. Drupa Trivedi will soon start the work on TB volatiles, which is following work I did in Tanzania. The reference is a popo, Joy Milne. It is a quite good description of what I did over there, and I have identified 17 molecules in TB. So hopefully, we're hoping to start this in the next 2 months. For me, I'm presently a member of the PD Avengers, and I'm part of the research group and a member of the women's group in PD. And with Parkinson's UK, Sue Whips and I are presenting a course for doctors and healthcare professionals on caring for the family and carers' partners living with PD. So I have used my 32 years of living with my husband as well as using my nose. Now, I'm with Dr. Alison Williams. We're about to publish a paper, and it's Rediscovering Happiness, the Impact of Physical and Cognitive Exercise in Parkinson's Disease as Measured by Odor Stratification. I met Alison at the second Edinburgh Research Interest Group lecture, and I looked at her, and in my mind, I said, damn this bloody disease. She was a couple of years older than me. She was hunched. I could hardly hear what she was saying. She was shuffling. Her arms were not moving. But she was obviously an intellectual. She is an honorary professor at Queen Margaret University in Edinburgh. Her conversation was, it was lovely to speak to her. So I went back home, I phoned Perdi and I said, I'm sorry, I know I am not allowed to tell anybody their smell, but I've just met this woman who is at a high three and she is embarking on an exercise program. I want to do the Vox on it. And Perdi said, right, okay, this is a one-off. You do it by yourselves. Nobody here knows what you're doing. So we have completed this work. And in Kyoto, we presented a poster. And if you think back to the different levels that I spoke about when I smell a swab, Alison was a high three. Within 3 years, she was a low one. She got flu in the middle and went up to two because she stopped her exercise, but she went back down to a one again. Now we are shortly hoping this will be published, and I hope, because her diaries are perfect and her program of her exercise, etc. But did you all know that tango is the best thing ever? Because she is superb at it. She remembers the steps and she flows through it really well. So I was fiddling with, you know, my synesthesia. I was fiddling with letters, looking at some words. And I thought, those letters make other words. So I would ask you not to be silent, to ask people to listen, to enlist and advocate as often as you can so that inlets can be made for the people who live with this disease and their families. I'd like to thank Dr. Taylor Kunos for his belief at the beginning. It was a huge momentum for Les in his final 2 years. 6 weeks before Les died, he was almost my Les again. And I that's how I put it. He was a doctor. He was interested in what was happening. He had sat down and written all his early signs and symptoms. And it is now the sparks of experience within the PD Avengers. I would like also to thank Professor Pradita Barn for her leadership and her friendship and support throughout this journey, which at times has been difficult, but she's always picked me up again. And the Barn group, they are such a pleasure to be with. And I do believe the early diagnosis is the panacea. Thank you.